You are listening to Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSH LP, Vashon Island, Washington. I am your host, Jeff Hoyt, interloping, interceding, showing up on the radio as I am wont to do, just out of the clear blue sky, whenever I've got something really interesting to impart to you. And the thing that I have to impart to you today is a really cool podcast that is produced right here on Vashon Island. It's called Labyrinths, and it's hosted by Amanda Knox and Christopher Robinson. Amanda and Chris, thanks for coming in.
Hello.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Yeah, good to see you both. And I am a big fan of Labyrinths. You're well over 100 episodes in to
this. Oh, God,
this.
Yeah. How many are we in now?
113 or something.
Wow.
Yeah. Not counting the fun debates we do between each official episode.
Oh, yes. Right.
Yeah. Oh, which are some of my favorites as well, and we'll probably find a way to air at least some of those that don't have obscenities throughout.
Ah, yes. They're playful debates between us that descend into chaos.
So Chris, tell me a little bit about the general podcast, Labyrinths. What's the whole thing about?
Well, it's about those times in a person's life when they felt lost or trapped and unsure of what was next and how they got out of that pickle, or if they did, mm-hmm. Because some people are still stuck in the labyrinth. And that can take the form of a very literal story, being lost somewhere. Mm-hmm. We've talked to people about, you know, transatlantic journeys in a rowboat alone, about summiting Mount Everest, tales of adventure. We've talked to people about dealing with mysterious medical complications, going through the journey of infertility, trying to get pregnant. And we've talked about wrongful conviction cases, which have a lot of resonance with Amanda's personal experience.
And Amanda, we of course know your story, or most of it, regarding your adventures in Italy and
that's all a nice word for that.
Yeah, misadventures in Italy. But this particular series that we're about to start, which is your most recent 6 episodes of Labyrinths, I would think would be particularly close to your heart. Tell us about what we're about to hear.
Yeah. You know, aside from episodes of Labyrinths where I talk directly about things that are going on with my case, these 6 episodes, this mini series about false confessions is really near and dear to my heart, because I was put through a course of interrogation while I was 20 years old abroad. My roommate had just been murdered. And it's been a long-standing source of pain in my life, because I was wrongly convicted of slander as a result of the statements that I was coerced into signing. And I think it's been the thing that people still struggle to comprehend about my experience. And it's even though it is a leading cause of wrongful convictions, at least 1 in 4 proven by DNA wrongful convictions involved false confessions. It remains this really potent source of injustice in so many cases, because it goes against common sense that someone would implicate themselves or others in a crime that they had nothing to do with. And so in this series, we deep dived with experts, but also people who have been through coercive interrogations and who falsely confessed, to give a really personal and broad view of this problem, how this problem is systemic, how interrogation techniques are designed to break the will of the person who is being interrogated, and solutions to these problems. Because really, the way that we can address these issues and these injustices is actually really common sense. And some of the solutions are just having a phone in your pocket and turning it on so that we can record what is happening behind closed doors in interrogation rooms.
That would make things so much simpler.
You'd think.
Mm-hmm. A documented record of just what happened.
Mm-hmm.
What are the, as I listened to the series, I noticed that there was kind of a similar playbook. There was sort of techniques that the police would use that were similar from case to case.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what those are?
Yeah. So there are various styles or methods, but they all tend to come down to there's different methodologies out there that are trained to police, but police are trained generally in a very specific technique that can be broken down into different phases. So, and Chris, jump in as whenever you would like.
I mean, the most prominent interrogation method is the Reed method of interrogation.
Named after
John E. Reed, who was a former Chicago police officer and polygraph expert, who in the late 1950s, in the wake of a history of third degree style interrogations,
smacking people around, you know, electrocuting them,
rubber hose, you know, like
holding people out of windows.
Like the Supreme Court came down and said, look, you can't treat a suspect that way. You're just going to, people will confess to anything if you abuse them like that. That was a great development, right? And but in the wake of that, the police started to figure out other psychological ways of abusing people without physically torturing them. And John E. Reed was the first, most prominent among these, who developed a set of techniques designed to get a person the police suspected of withholding guilty knowledge, to get that person to confess. And it began with the two phases Amanda mentioned are what they call the behavioral analysis interview. This is the first part, and it's a supposedly neutral interview where they're merely attempting to gather information, build a rapport. But if the result of that interview is, I think this person is hiding something, then they shift into phase two, which is a set of 9 steps designed to push that person to become compliant and to confess what they know. And as the false confessions experts we talk to in this series will tell you, that wouldn't be a problem if the police were good at detecting who is a liar and who isn't.
Right.
If the only people who ended up in phase two were actually guilty people who were hiding guilty knowledge, then that set of steps it is effective at pushing them to confess. The problem is the police are no better than flipping a coin, and studies have shown this, they're no better than the average public at detecting deception, and the average public is no better than flipping a coin. And what that means is that half the time, the person who ends up in that guilt presumptive 9 steps is an innocent person. And the series of coercive practices, the pressure, the
bullying.
So there's,
I mean, I think some of the most problematic aspects of it is there are sort of implied, there's not like explicit promises of leniency if you confess, or there's not explicit promises of punishment if you don't confess, but there are implied things. There's also, I think one of the most dangerous aspects of this interrogation method is how they employ deception. So police lie to you. They lie to your face about what evidence they have. And
they lied to you.
Well, they lied to me, indeed. And when you base an interrogation around lies, it warps the person who's sitting across from the liar. Suddenly their reality starts warping, and they're trying to figure out how to make sense of what is being told to them, which is a lie. And so,
yeah, like if they say, we have your fingerprints on the murder weapon, and if you don't know that the police can lie to you, I mean, it's illegal for you to lie to the police. And a lot of people assume the police are not allowed to lie to them, but the Supreme Court has ruled that they are in fact allowed to use deception. And so you're sitting there in that interrogation room thinking, how could this possibly be?
Right.
So, are my own memories suspect here? Could I have actually done this? And then the police will offer you minimization themes. This is another big part of the Reed technique, where they downplay your involvement in some particular way, offering you an alternative that seems to reduce your culpability, but which still legally holds you just as culpable.
So, for instance, saying, oh, maybe you were there, but you were just observing that the other person was raping and murdering when you just saw it. But there you go. Then you place yourself at the crime scene. And then suddenly once they get you to admit that, then they try to make you admit further and further and further. And so it's interesting. Like, deception is so scary because it affects people in different ways. Some people look at the deception, the lie, there's your fingerprints on the murder weapon, and they go, logically, if my fingerprints are on the murder weapon, I have no idea how it got there. I'm being framed. Even if I profess my innocence, no one's going to believe me. I better just confess, because that's going to get me a limit. Like, they'll give me less time in prison. And so they'll confess knowing that they're falsely confessing. Other people, it screws with their head, and it makes them think, could I be could I have had something to do with this? And then the police will introduce this idea that you blacked it out and that you don't remember the truth because it is so traumatic. And this is, again, what happened to me.
Right.
This
idea. How destabilizing was it for you to be told that Raffaele, your co-defendant, had turned on you when in fact he hadn't?
I mean, it was tremendously destabilizing. The entire thing was destabilizing. I think one thing that people don't remember is that in some of these wrongful conviction cases, they will pick somebody out of the blue who just like literally was a stranger on the street in the vicinity of something bad happening, had no idea what it was going on, and therefore they're brought to the police office not even knowing why they're being brought there. We interviewed a guy named Eddie Lowry who thought that he was being brought into the police office because of a car accident. And then there are other people like me who my roommate had just been murdered. So already I was psychologically destabilized by the mere fact that like I had gone home and my home was a crime scene all of a sudden. And then you introduce a person in that vulnerable state to really, really suggestive and coercive interrogation techniques. So yes, when I was sitting there across from the police officers, they're telling me, we know you were physically present there at the scene of the crime. Raffaele, your co-defendant or your boyfriend, says that you weren't with him the night of the murder. You must not remember the truth because you had witnessed something so horrible. Like, there's only, after hours and hours and hours of this, you start to question your own sanity. At least I did. And for a long time after everything that happened to me, I really did feel like there was something uniquely wrong with me. Like everyone sort of blamed me and accused me of lying, and even people who believed in my innocence, there was this sense of like, oh, did she sort of bring her wrongful conviction on herself because she falsely confessed? And there's this like, I discovered after coming home that, first of all, I was not the first person who had ever falsely confessed to something. And two, that I was also not alone in those feelings of self-hatred and self-blame, and that I had sort of adopted because of the messaging that was sent to me from the outside world that was really, really unforgiving and not understanding my experience. And we talk about that too in the final episode of the series, is like the long consequences.
The scars, the psychological trauma that lasts, and the solutions for how to prevent this from happening to more people.
I know that you're working on legislation to prevent the police from being able to lie.
Yeah, absolutely. So last year I testified down in Olympia attempting to help pass a bill that would prevent deception in custodial interrogations. So again, that's a very specific situation where the police have Mirandized you. You are in custody. Mm-hmm. And we were just trying at that point to prevent them from lying to you and introducing that false reality that can destabilize you psychologically. And I was really shocked when the opposing side, the opposing counsel, the representative from the police, just stepped forward and very unapologetically pronounced that you cannot do a policeman's job without lying to people. And I was just shocked.
And you wonder why communities have lost their trust in their police, which are supposed to serve them.
Right.
Now, if you lie to your community, you're going to destroy the rapport that you're supposed to be building, and it's going to make your job harder to get accurate information when
and
there is a
crime.
And it's
simply not true. You don't have to lie to people in order to get information out of them. You just have to have evidence and put like actual evidence and put it in front of them.
The series is called False Confessions, a Labyrinths miniseries, part of the Labyrinths podcast that comes out on a semi-regular basis right out of your home studio here on Vashon Island. I think it's going to blow people's minds, and so I just insisted that we find a way to put it on the air. It'll be right here at 4 o'clock on Wednesday afternoons, and then once we get through the False Confessions series, we'll dig back into your archive and pull out some favorite episodes to air on Voice of Vashon. And I just think it's fantastic work. It's really first-rate journalism, and congratulations, especially on this particular series, which is fabulous.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Episode 1 starts right now.
And I kept telling him, that's not true. I'm not lying to you. I'm telling you the truth. I was just extremely scared and confused. I didn't know what was going on. It was just a horrendous experience for an 18-year-old kid like myself in that interrogation room. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be there. Finally, at the end, he told me, hey, listen, there's a very pretty lady in another room. She's going to ask you some questions. This woman happened to be the ADA. So every time she was asking me a question, the detective, he was still giving me a very intimidating look. Once she finalized the whole entire interview, she asked me one final question. And she said, is there anything else you would like to say? And in my mind, I'm like, yeah, I want to tell her the truth. I want to tell her that all of this was a lie. But because he was there, I was scared to death. I did not say anything. After that, they took me straight to Rikers Island.
Feeling lost?
Then you're in the right place.
I'm Amanda Knox.
And I'm Christopher Robinson.
And this
is False Confessions,
a Labyrinths miniseries.
The man you just heard was Johnny Hincapier. In 1990, at the age of 18, he confessed to one of New York City's most notorious murders, the stabbing of a tourist on a subway platform. But Johnny Hincapier is no killer. He's a friend of ours, and he spent 25 years in prison before he was exonerated of this crime. It's hard to imagine what could lead an innocent person to confess. Most of us think, well, I would never admit to something I didn't do, especially if it would land me in prison or on death row. That's why confessions are so powerful to juries.
But false confessions do not happen in a vacuum. They are almost always the result of prolonged pressure and coercion by law enforcement. That was my experience when I was coerced into signing false statements at the age of 20, after 53 hours of questioning over 5 days. I have never felt more terrified, confused, and frankly, insane than the police made me feel in that interrogation room. And what's truly mind-boggling is that I believe the police genuinely thought they were getting at the truth by mentally breaking me. That's because the methods police use can fool even themselves, making them the unwitting authors of the confessions they think they are extracting from suspects.
As hard as this phenomenon is to understand, it's far from rare. According to Innocence Project data on the first 375 DNA exonerations, 29% involved a false confession. Studies also estimate that anywhere between 1 and 4% of convictions are wrongful. And given that there are nearly 2 million people incarcerated in our prisons and jails, that's at least 20,000 innocent people in prison and upwards of 5,000 who wound up there after falsely confessing. That's a staggering problem, and that's just in the U.S.
Of all the contributing factors in my own wrongful conviction, my false confession was the seed that spun everything awry and led to the last 17 years of injustice. As of today, I am still appealing a conviction for criminal slander for the statements I signed shortly before I was arrested in 2007 and charged with murder. If you want the full story on my own interrogation, confession, and my ongoing legal battle to clear my name, go back and listen to Labyrinths number 79, still on trial in Italy, and number 93, Injustice in Florence. The subject of false confessions is also close to our hearts because we've made many friends in the innocence community who were also coerced into giving false testimony. And you'll hear from quite a few of them in this miniseries. I've found a great deal of healing in connecting with them over our shared trauma.
We'll also be talking to the world's foremost experts in the psychology of false confessions, police interrogation methods, cognitive bias, and false memory implantation, to understand what leads people to confess to crimes they didn't commit, and what changes can be made to prevent this from happening in the future. No one thinks it could happen to them, until it does. And by the end of this series, we hope you'll be better equipped to resist the pressure if you ever find yourself accused of a crime you didn't commit.
Welcome to False Confessions, a Labyrinths miniseries. This is part 1 of 6.
You may picture a bare light bulb hanging over a metal desk.
a tape recorder, and autopsy photos. The good cop, bad cop routine with other detectives behind a two-way mirror. But long before this stereotype of the interrogation room, confessions took place in churches. Confession in a legal context has its origins during the Inquisitions of medieval Europe. In 1252 AD, Pope Innocent IV issued a papal bull authorizing torture for the purposes of eliciting confessions from heretics. And over the next few centuries, inquisitions arose across Europe, led by inquisitors from the Dominican and Franciscan orders. Their aim was to root out heresy, blasphemy, witchcraft, and other deviant behaviors and beliefs.
The accused might be hung from the ceiling with their arms bound behind their back, then dropped violently to dislocate their shoulders. Or they'd be placed on the potro, or rack, where they'd be slowly stretched on a wooden table until their joints gave way. Or the inquisitors would administer the water cure, essentially waterboarding, stuffing a cloth in the mouth and pouring water over it to create the sensation of drowning. Confession was the only evidence needed to find someone guilty of heresy. And unsurprisingly, many people falsely confessed to sins under such circumstances. We know their confessions were false because, well, witchcraft is not real.
From looking back at the historical record kept by churches during this period, the majority of those found guilty were sentenced to various forms of penance. But those executed for heresy, apostasy, and witchcraft numbered in the thousands. And most inquisitions were not abolished in Europe until the 19th century. Christian ideology still pervades our criminal justice system today, especially in the importance we place on confession.
The confession is, in that sense, sort of culturally different than other forms of evidence.
That's Laura Nyreiter, false confessions expert and former co-director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth.
I mean, there's the sacrament of penance. This is a cornerstone of absolution of the soul. And, you know, confessing your sins is absolutely critical to salvation.
Admitting fault, expressing remorse, vowing never to commit that sin again. It's no accident that this is essentially what a modern parole board expects to hear from an inmate asking for release.
And I do think that for millennia, the notion of confession has taken on universal significance. It's prized above other forms of evidence in so many of our minds for that reason, right? They said they did it. They confessed their sins. There's almost a desire to believe it for their own good.
Confession also absolves the rest of society of their own feelings of guilt for meting out punishment. And practically speaking, for centuries, there wasn't much else in the way of evidence to go on.
If you look back into Jack the Ripper days, you couldn't get fingerprints. I don't know if they could even type blood back then. There is no way you're going to get somebody without a witness or evidence like the knife.
That's former FBI Special Agent Steve Moore.
Early on, a confession was crucial because a lot of times that's all you had.
While the more extreme forms of torture used to extract confessions were discontinued over time, many physical and psychological forms of pressure have remained a constant since the Inquisition and the Salem witch trials. Suspects may be kept in solitary confinement, without human contact or natural light, or deprived of sleep. They may be threatened with execution, presented with false evidence of their guilt, and their friends and family may equally be pressured to denounce them. And until quite recently, physical beatings by police and investigators remained common in closed-door interrogations. When such pressures are applied, false confessions are inevitable.
Aside from the 55 people in Salem, Massachusetts, who confessed to witchcraft in 1692, the first documented wrongful conviction for earthly crimes in the United States was that of brothers Jesse and Stephen Bourne in Vermont in 1819. Their sister's husband, Russell Colvin, had gone missing.
They didn't like him. Everybody knew they didn't like him. He disappeared. They confessed to killing him. They were both in prison. One of them was actually set to be executed.
That's Dr. Saul Kasson, a psychologist and leading expert on false confessions, who you'll hear from extensively throughout this series.
And the victim was found alive in New Jersey. There was no murder. The first known wrongful conviction in the U.S. in 1819 involved two false confessions.
Like those in Salem, the Bourne's crime was non-existent, a particularly troubling aspect of false confessions. Why did they confess? The better question is, what sort of pressure were they put under?
Up through the 1930s, police routinely extracted confessions from suspected criminals by giving them the so-called third degree, depriving them of food, water, and sleep, beating them with bare fists or with a rubber hose. This happened to the three black tenant farmers who were whipped, pummeled, and tortured into confessing to murder in 1934. The Supreme Court overturned their convictions in 1936, writing that a trial is a mere pretense when the state authorities have contrived a conviction resting solely upon confessions obtained by violence, and that this was a clear denial of due process.
With third-degree confessions no longer accepted in court, the police found more psychological methods of interrogating suspects. By 1940, a man named W.R. Kidd published the first police interrogation manual, noting that the third degree does not produce the truth. Under sufficient torture, a man will tell you anything you want to know. According to false confessions expert Dr. Richard Leo, who you'll hear from later, by the 1940s, most police leaders universally condemned the third degree as immoral under all circumstances, and American police soon came to perceive the third degree not only as unethical and illegal, but also as less effective at eliciting confessions than modern interrogation techniques.
By the 1960s, the third degree was virtually non-existent in police interrogations. That isn't to say that police brutality disappeared, especially towards minority suspects. Such exceptions prove the rule in a way. The police beating of Rodney King wouldn't have made headlines in 1930. In 1992, it caused citywide riots in Los Angeles. That said, the third degree has not disappeared. During the Vietnam War, American POWs were tortured by the Viet Cong into confessing to war crimes. Among the techniques they employed was waterboarding, which American intelligence officers used against al-Qaeda operatives at Guantanamo Bay Military Prison.
In American police departments, with the rise of police body cams and video recording for custodial interrogation, such third-degree tactics have dissipated. But there are still plenty of moments when the police don't have the cameras on, thanks to loopholes that don't require them to turn on the cameras. And then it's the cop's word versus the suspect's. In such situations, physical violence still occurs. But perhaps more importantly, as Dr. Leo argues, modern psychological interrogation grew out of the third degree. It contained a master psychological logic, the infliction of assault and terror, in order to elicit compliance and extract admissions. That is still evident in how police coerce suspects into confessions today, their methods intertwined with this violent history, from the third degree back through the Inquisition, and with the idea that the truth is there to be extracted from the guilty if only they are put under sufficient pressure. All of that is especially clear in the story of Johnny Hincapié. In New York City in 1990, there were 2,245 homicides, an average of more than six a day. It was the peak of the crack epidemic, and aside from murders, the city was overrun with muggings, robberies, assaults, rapes, and other crimes.
Felonies and robberies are up, breaking previous crime records. Just this afternoon, there was a shooting on the number 6 line at 125th Street. One person was rushed to the hospital after being shot 3 times in the chest.
Just one more in a growing number of incidents that have caused the crime rate to soar to its highest level since 1982.
That summer, a dozen children were killed by stray bullets. Nowhere felt safe. Just the year prior, a woman had been attacked and raped while running through Central Park.
This morning, the woman jogger was found unconscious and bleeding by two men passing by at about 2 o'clock this morning. We're told she was taken to Metropolitan Hospital, where she's being treated for a fractured skull and a serious loss of blood.
She was left for dead and suffered severe brain damage. The NYPD moved quickly to solve the Central Park jogger case, and 2 days later, the police made arrests.
Five teens between the ages of 15 and 17 were charged with numerous rape, sodomy, and assault counts. All of the defendants gave videotaped statements to police implicating themselves or others, but some of their attorneys charged today that police obtained the confessions by force.
We'll return to those confessions in a later episode, but suffice it to say that their pleas of coercion fell on deaf ears.
10 days after that, Donald Trump took out full-page ads in the city's major newspapers, calling for the return of the death penalty, writing, "I want to hate these muggers and murderers. They should be forced to suffer." The ad was widely condemned, even at the time, but it revealed the undercurrent of anger and frustration and fear that was coursing through the city. New Yorkers were fed up and scared. In this climate of fear, another murder rocked New York City.
Tourist Brian Watkins was in the subway on September 3rd, 1990, when he was stabbed in the chest after a struggle with at least six teenagers who robbed his father and hit his mother.
Brian Watkins, a 22-year-old Mormon tourist from Utah, was visiting the city to watch the U.S. Open with his parents. As they waited for a subway train at 53rd Street, a group of 6 to 8 teenagers mobbed them in an attempted mugging. Brian Watkins' father was slashed with a box cutter, and his mother was kicked in the face. When Brian tried to intervene, he was stabbed in the chest. He chased the teens up to the landing, but collapsed with a severed pulmonary artery. He died on the way to the hospital.
This killing became known as the subway murder, and the New York Post headline the next day became infamous. "Dave, do something!" It was an angry shout directed at Mayor David Dinkins, and below it were headlines for columns with titles that read, "New York's streets are awash in blood," and "We are captives in our homes."
I'm damn angry. Of course I am.
Again, with the pressure on, the NYPD moved quickly to arrest this wolf pack, as it became known, sending out dozens of police to round up suspects, including some of the same detectives from the Central Park jogger case. Within 24 hours, they had arrested 8 suspects. One of them was 18-year-old Johnny Hincapier.
Johnny was among a group of 40 to 50 teens that arrived on a train from Queens to head out for a night of dancing at a club on 52nd Street. Most of those teens exited the subway, but a small group, lacking cash for the nightclub, hopped back over the turnstile and went back to the subway platform to mug somebody.
I went home that night after going out to the nightclub. I slept in late, turned on the TV. The mayor came out on the news and he made it known that they wanted to arrest anybody and everybody that had anything to do with this, no matter what. I really didn't have nothing to worry about because in my mind, I didn't see anything happen and I didn't know that anything had happened. Later on that night, detectives came to my house. My mother was the one that answered the door. Nothing like what you see on TV or in the movies where they show you that they're standing outside of the door, they're identifying themselves. No, they just barged inside our home. My mother's like, "What's going on?" And that's all of a sudden when they come to show their identification to my mother. "Are you the mother of Johnny Hincapié?" And she's like, "Yes, why? What happened?" She says, "Well, we need to speak to Johnny." My mother calls me. I'm upstairs in my room. She calls me. I come downstairs and I see a bunch of men in our home, and I don't know why.
Are they in uniform or in plain clothes?
They're in plain clothes. They were detectives.
So strange men that you don't know, demanding to talk to you.
Immediately, they told my mother, "He needs to go with us to the precinct." And my mother was like, "Why? My son didn't do anything." So I said, "No, we need to take him." My mother was like, "Well, let me go with him." He says, "How old is he?" And he said, "He just turned 18 years old. And they told my mother, "Well, you can't go with him. He's old enough. he has to go by himself with us. One detective grabbed me by one arm, the other detective grabbed me by the other arm, and they just dragged me out of my home. And my mother started yelling and screaming. One of the people that was arrested prior to me, the detective said, I need to know the names of everybody that went out with you to the nightclub that night. And the guy, he said, I don't know everybody, but I know a few people that I know that went out with me that night to the nightclub. And out of those few people, he mentioned my name and he gave them my phone number and my address is where I live because I knew the guy. But this guy actually had something to do with the crime. So that was the only reason why the detectives came to my house to take me to the precinct.
That's wild. Like, he didn't even say you had anything to do with the crime. He just said you went to the nightclub.
Correct. That's it. Nothing else. That was it. They were very, very, very quiet. They weren't playing the good cop, bad cop role inside the squad car. They were just making it very intense.
The police handcuffed Johnny and put a coat over his head as they perp walked him past a horde of reporters outside the police station. After a short wait, they led him into the interrogation room.
There were bunk beds. There was tables and chairs. It was dark and gloomy. When I walked in, the detective was already laying on one of the bunk beds. He had his pack of cigarettes rolled up on his T-shirt, you know, and he was just smoking away.
Bizarre. This is the first time I've ever heard of an interrogation room with bunk beds in it. So then what happened?
The detective asked me to tell him what I did that night. And I told him I went with a group of guys, took the subway, went to the nightclub. After it ended, I went home and that was it. And he was really, really upset. And he was like, you're lying. You're not telling the truth. And I have a group of your friends in another room and they already told me what happened. And I kept telling him, that's not true. I'm not lying to you. I'm telling you the truth. And he, after that, he just went crazy on me. He was blowing smoke in my face. He started hitting me. He pulled my hair. He kicked me in my chest and knocked me down to the ground. And because I had a ponytail and I was handcuffed, he viciously took me from my ponytail and my hair and just yanked my hair really hard up like that to get me back in a sitting position, but so hard. It's not like he did it slowly. He did it very hard. This went on and he slapped me in my face. And I was just extremely, extremely scared and confused. I was crying. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't understand why he was beating me up. It was just a horrendous experience. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be there. I really, really thought that he was going to kill me.
Mm.
Basically, he's telling me throughout this whole process that he wants me to memorize a story. He says, I'm going to tell you a story. If you memorize the story and you repeat this story to somebody else that I'm going to introduce you to, I can have somebody take you home immediately. So I asked him, I said, one simple question. I said, if my attorney was here, what would he say about me memorizing this story? And he looked at me and he said, your attorney will tell you to do the same thing. And I knew in my heart that he was lying to me, but at the same time, I wasn't sure. He beat me up and now he's trying to say he wants to help me out over here. You know, I'm saying to myself, should I believe him? Is he telling me the truth that he's actually going to take me home if I memorize this story? So after I asked that question and he responded to me, I said, okay, sure, I'll memorize whatever you want me to say.
This kind of third-degree treatment had been deemed illegal in the United States since the 1930s, and it was widely recognized that sufficient physical harm could induce a person to confess to anything, making it a wildly unreliable method of getting at the truth. But so often, as in Johnny's case, the police were not interested in getting information from him. They'd already formed a conclusion based on interrogating other suspects and on investigative intuition. and they were only interested in getting Johnny to repeat a story they already believed to be true. And when the cameras are off, it's the suspect's word versus the cop's. Who is a jury going to believe?
That's exactly what happened in my interrogation. Unlike every other moment I was questioned in that police station in 2007, this final interrogation, late into the night, was not recorded. It was then that I was screamed at and slapped in the back of the head. The police, of course, denied this, and when I later said in public that they'd physically hit me, I was charged with criminal slander against the police. My mother was even charged with criminal slander for repeating to the press the truth of how I was abused by the police that night. And the more exonerees I've met, the more I've heard stories like this.
I was choked at one point, I was thrown up against a wall.
That's Marty Tankliff, who was 17 when he was accused of murdering his parents in 1988. You'll hear more from him in a later episode. This kind of treatment was far from rare in the late 80s and early 90s, especially in major urban centers overrun with crime. In Chicago, Police Commissioner John Burge oversaw and sometimes participated in the torture of at least 118 people between 1972 and 1991. To elicit confessions, his Midnight Crew, as they were known, used a wide variety of third-degree methods, from beating to suffocation, and even electric shock to the genitals. His abuses were finally coming to light around the time when Johnny was getting his own third-degree treatment.
He tells me to memorize the story. He's basically telling me, listen, the story that I'm going to give you is you're going to be like a witness. After I finished memorizing the story, he's telling me, hey, listen, there's a very pretty lady in another room. She's going to ask you some questions based on what I told you to memorize. And whatever she asks you, answer the questions based on the story. And that's exactly what I did. This woman happened to be the ADA, the assistant district attorney. It was her, the cameraman, and the detective plus his partner sitting behind her. So every time she was asking me a question and I was answering the question or about to answer the question, the detective would look dead in my eye. You know, he was like still giving me a mean, mean look.
Like, you better say what I want you to say.
Between some of the answers that I was giving me, he was like nodding his head. But it was a combination of the two. That's what took place at the very end. And when I was regurgitating everything that I memorized to the ADA, once she finalized the whole entire interview, she asked me one final question. And she said, is there anything else you would like to say? And in my mind, I'm like, yeah, I want to tell her the truth. I want to tell her that all of this was a lie, that he made me tell you this, that he finished beating me up. But because he was there, I was scared to death. I did not say anything. But that's exactly what I wanted to say, and I didn't.
When Johnny Hincapier finally felt safe enough to speak out against his abuse, the court didn't listen. Like in so many of the cases you'll hear about in this series, Johnny's confession sealed his fate. He was convicted, alongside seven others who actually participated in the murder. And he spent more than 25 years in prison until he saw justice.
The only thing that linked Johnny Hincapier to the subway murder was the mere mention that he was part of a group of teens headed to a nightclub that night. In fact, another suspect, who had been present when Brian Watkins was murdered, confirmed that Johnny was not involved. Why didn't that evidence matter? The fact is, even DNA evidence often isn't enough.
Confessions are quite simply the most powerful piece of evidence in a court of law. And the reason is because jurors, the general public, prosecutors, and even defense attorneys, and certainly judges, for years didn't understand how someone could ever confess to a crime they didn't commit.
That's Steve Drizin, director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern Law. He's a false confessions expert and lawyer who represents Brendan Dassey, among others.
And because it's such a counterintuitive idea, when a jury hears that a defendant confessed, it's a huge hump for the defense attorneys to overcome. Jurors understand, I think, increasingly that DNA evidence is extremely powerful and provides a certitude that even confessions don't provide. But I've seen many cases where DNA evidence excludes a suspect from being the source of genetic material found on a crime victim. And juries will still convict them, even under preposterous theories that are put forward by prosecutors. So in a one-on-one battle between a confession and DNA evidence, it's going to be a very close call which piece of evidence the jury is going to credit.
Is there an example of that? You know, DNA excluded them, but the confession was there, and so the prosecution was putting forth a preposterous hypothesis, and it was bought by the jury?
Yeah, we've been involved in a number of cases here in Chicago where multiple young African-American teenagers falsely confessed to murders and rapes. And at the time of their trial, DNA evidence was available, and the DNA evidence excluded all of the teenagers. In the Englewood 4 case, we're talking about 4 false confessions. In the Marquette 4 case, we're talking about 4 false confessions. And in the Dixmoor 5 case, 3 of the 5 defendants falsely confessed. In each one of those cases, genetic evidence or fingerprint evidence excluded the defendants prior to trial. In the cases of the Dixmoor 5 and the Englewood 4, what you had is multiple defendants who were excluded at the time of trial. And the theory of the state became, well, there must have been one teenager who got away, right? Or the defendants were wearing condoms, or somehow they didn't ejaculate when they were having sex with the victim. You know, the most bizarre thing in the Dixmoor case was that when we finally found whose DNA was on the victim, prosecutors went through a whole other round of ridiculous explanations, even though the DNA matched to a serial sexual predator. They claimed that the 5 boys murdered her, and then this sexual predator came upon her body and ejaculated on her. So it's mind-boggling.
That prosecutorial cope, by the way, is common enough in these situations that to those who do innocence work, it's become known as the unindicted co-ejaculator theory. The absurdity of that claim, that the DNA evidence from a rape kit matching someone else doesn't necessarily mean the suspect who confessed didn't also rape the victim, should tell you how hard it is, even for law enforcement, to discount confession evidence.
A confession, maybe next to an eyewitness identification, is among the absolutely strongest evidence that the state can put on in any prosecution. And it taps into that me versus them sense of the jury.
That's Laura Zarovsky, the executive and policy director of the Washington Innocence Project.
I think that there is something very fundamental about being a human being and needing things to make sense. We need an answer. And how often have we heard, when you hear about a horrific crime, somebody must pay? There is a real willingness to accept whatever law enforcement and prosecutors are putting forward because, well, they must know more than me, and this doesn't look right, but they had the whole picture, and why would they charge somebody if they didn't actually do it? And that paired with like this insane overconfidence by law enforcement and prosecutors in knowing who the bad guys are and who the bad people are and that they're different than us. That arrogance, that bias, destroys lives. It destroys lives and it prevents actual justice of any form from being found. Law enforcement knows that they have tied up their case and their investigation and finished it off with a bow if the person that they suspect has confessed. They don't have to go further because juries don't require more. And juries should require more. Well, courts should require more because the kind of statements, the kind of incriminating statements that under the law right now are allowed are bonkers. Ted Bradford had dozens of inconsistencies between his statement and the facts of the crime. They had to lead him through all of these different options before he actually said the right answer that was consistent with the evidence. Things as important as leaving out the fact that there was an infant screaming throughout the attack. I mean, astonishing things that could not have been left out if it was a true confession. And yet, the question before the court when they're deciding whether to admit a confession, the only question is, was it voluntary? That's the only question. It's not, was it reliable?
A prime reason why juries are so likely to believe a confession is because we are all afflicted with a cognitive bias known as the fundamental attribution error. It's so endemic that it's known as one of the foundational principles of social psychology. When judging our own behavior, we tend to emphasize situational factors. I was speeding because I was late. But when we judge the behavior of others, we tend to assume a personal, innate explanation. He stole the money because he's a bad person. In the case of a confession, any human observer is likely to give less weight to the situational context of police coercion than to what they imagine that confession says about the character of the confessor. Coupled with the truth bias, our tendency to take things at face value until proven otherwise, a confession alone can sway a jury.
Dr. Saul Kassin, who you heard from earlier, conducted a series of studies to test the effect of confessions on jury decision-making. The control group who saw no confession evidence only voted guilty 19% of the time. When presented with a confession given under low pressure, they judged the confession to be voluntary 88% of the time and voted guilty 63% of the time. But even when presented with a confession given under duress, and when judging the confession to be voluntary only 44% of the time, the mock jurors still voted guilty 50% of the time, compared to the 19% baseline. When he conducted a similar study with judges, only 32% of judges considered the confession in the high-pressure scenario to be voluntary, and over two-thirds ruled to suppress it. And yet, 69% of judges in that condition still voted guilty, compared to a baseline of 17%.
There are few people in the world who understand this issue as well as Dr. Saul Kassin, who has spent decades researching false confessions. And one thing he's found is that false confessions are so powerful in court because they also taint all the other evidence.
We need to ensure that false confessions don't happen in the first place, because once they do, pardon my language, all hell breaks loose. So once an individual confesses to a crime, if they decide and they're bold enough to go to trial, often against the advice of their attorneys, they will likely get convicted. The jury research on that is clear. Confession evidence is powerful, potent, more so than other types of evidence. If you go to trial with a confession, you're likely to get convicted. For that reason, when you look at the exoneree population and look at the number of those who got there, not by trial, but because they caved and accepted a guilty plea, the percentage of people who accept a guilty plea has a disproportionate number of those who previously confessed. Why? Their lawyers are saying, you should accept this deal, you're going to get convicted. So a false confession, you're going to get convicted at trial. If you don't go to trial, you're more likely to plead guilty to the thing you didn't do. If you do go to trial, here's what's going to happen. And God, Amanda, your case shows this as well as any. All of a sudden, the evidence around you will be corrupted to fit the confession. all of a sudden witnesses will claim they saw something they didn't really see, or they're confused about what they saw. All of a sudden, the alibi who thought they could vouch for you at a particular place and time, maybe they're not so sure about that place and time. And then all of a sudden, the forensic science evidence falls into place, and all of a sudden, the autopsy confirms the conclusion that you had something to do with it. And there is right now a growing and large body of research on forensic confirmation biases showing that forensic examiners are biased by confession. They should be shielded from information about a confession.
There's another expert whose work has focused explicitly on this. Dr. E.T.L. Dror, who we interviewed back in episode 52 of Labyrinths, has shown through many cleverly designed research studies how confirmation bias can taint the judgments of forensic scientists who are making determinations about everything from fingerprints to DNA analysis to autopsy reports.
There are two pieces of evidence that are the most convincing. One is forensic science, and the other one is confession. And those two interact with one another, because when they come to someone and say, we have forensic evidence against you, they're more likely to confess. And if the forensic examiner knows that the person confessed, they're more likely to see that the evidence match when actually it does not. So this is kind of the bias snowball effect that I talk about, and it's very powerful in convicting wrongful people. And I would like to say the opposite too, and not convicting guilty people. It's not only about convicting innocent, it's about letting people who are guilty walk free.
But there are ways to prevent this.
Yeah, there are two very simple things. Part number one, when possible, not to expose experts to information they do not need, irrelevant contextual information. For example, we did research in the United States and found that fingerprint examiners, where they're comparing fingerprints, 40% of the time they know if the suspect has a criminal record. Why do they know if the suspect has a criminal record or not?
The same is true of confessions. Whether or not a suspect confessed should have no bearing on whether two fingerprints match. But all too often, fingerprint analysts are given that information, which can potentially bias their judgments.
So in every forensic domain, the experts should get only the relevant information that is the correct data to make the decision.
Unfortunately, this still rarely happens. And because interrogations often happen before forensic evidence is analyzed, a confession, whether false or true, is one of the first pieces of evidence investigators have, which biases their collection of other evidence. And because it's such potent evidence in court, whether it's supported by forensic evidence or not, there's a high incentive for law enforcement to obtain a confession. Hence the persistence of the kind of third-degree methods used on Johnny Hincapier. But the police don't need to resort to physical violence to coerce a confession.
The problem with the third degree, not just that the third degree induces false confessions, because everybody has a breaking point. I worry that the third degree has become something of an anchor point by which people judge a psychologically oriented police-induced confession. I've heard it said before, well, they didn't beat him. They didn't slap him. They didn't threaten to throw him out of the window. Guys, that's not the standard we set. Yes, the physical harm, the enhanced type interrogation tactics can produce false confessions, but so can psychological tactics based in deception have that same effect. And I worry that by talking about third degree, we're setting a very low bar on what is considered coercive. And I hear it all the time. Would you ever confess to a crime you didn't commit? Do you imagine doing that? I've been asking that question for 40 some years. Well, not if he didn't beat me, or not if he didn't put a gun to my head. And so that's the standard, and I worry that that standard enables people to overlook the psychological forces and dismiss the psychological forces as not that big a deal. And so that's a concern I have for even talking about the third degree. The third degree goes without saying. But my point is, and I think the research shows, you could produce those same effects using psychological tactics.
That's the subject of our next episode, How to Break the Mind.
In the meantime, get lost with us. Find us on Blue Sky at amandanox.com.
At wisecracker.bsky.social.
On Instagram at amamanox.
At mccarbon.
You can learn more about our work and how to support it at amandanox.com. And we won't resort to the rubber hose to get a 5-star review out of you, so we'll just ask you nicely. If you're enjoying Labyrinths, please spread the word.
False Confessions, a Labyrinths miniseries, is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. This episode was written and produced by us, along with our managing producer, Andre Sapp, and our production assistant, Charlie Darnell. Our theme music is by Josh Budo Karp.